Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everyone. Jesse and I recently helped our beloved Richard Sherman celebrate his 94th birthday. He is a living legend and a bona fide Disney legend who, with his brother Bob, wrote songs we all know and love, from Mary Poppins, The Jungle Book, and Disneyland, to name just a few of his many credits. We spoke to him in 2016 and thought it would be fun to play that episode again. His passion for music and life is inspiring, and we feel very lucky to know him.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And this is Maltin on Movies. And we have a guest today. You know, I hate being a name dropper. I don't like to do that. And I used to make fun of hosts who would always say, oh, this is a dear, close, personal friend. But I have to tell the truth. This is an old family friend that we're about to introduce. And yet, you think it was easy to book him today? No. I'm talking about the great Richard Sherman, one half of the immortal Sherman Brothers songwriting duo. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Leonard. It's great to be here.
And who are they? You know, the guys who wrote the Mary Poppins songs and won 2 Academy Awards for it? The guys who wrote It's a Small World? The guys who wrote I Want to Be Like You from The Jungle Book? Those guys. Oh. But as I say, it wasn't easy to book Richard because he's in demand. He's working. Last week at this time, you were in a recording studio.
I was, that's right.
Tell us what you were doing.
Let me see. What was I doing last
week? That was your unrecorded song.
Oh, that's right. Well, actually, a good friend of mine, Bruce Kimmel, is a producer of recordings that are rare sometimes, and he's very, very prolific. He's done so many shows and everything. One day he wanted to release an old show of mine that on his recording label, and I didn't like the recording. I thought it wasn't worthy of being seen. I said, but you know, it's a funny thing. When I pulled out that old record, I found a couple of demos of shows that I did that were never produced before, and he showed a lot of interest. I said, well, you know, I was going to do a production of book. That was James Thurber's 13 Clocks, the 13 Clocks at Warner Brothers. And it was going great. We were working with a marvelous producer that produced Wizard of Oz.
Mervyn LeRoy.
Mervyn LeRoy, and he was a wonderful man. And everything was going beautifully, and all of a sudden they pulled the plug on it. And this whole score was composed and written, and the book was written. It was very, very exciting project, and it was gone. And that hit us very terribly. And the next thing we knew, we were working on some songs for a proposed version of Roman Holiday, that wonderful movie.
Oh, the wonderful
movie.
Film with Audrey Hepburn and Gregory Peck.
She won the Academy Award for that.
Mm-hmm. I'm singing Roman Holiday to Jolly Holiday right now. You've just...
I never thought about
that. Could have been.
That could have been a good idea.
So were these were completed scores?
No, this was we had begun the score on Roman Holiday. But then we had done a third project. All these things were canceled. It was a fallow period when there were a lot of failures of musicals, and they decided, no more musicals. We're not going to do musicals. So the third one was an original called Sir Puss in Boots, which was based on the Puss in Boots legend, but there was a tremendous amount of additional material. Bob and I did the script as well as the score on it.
Oh, my.
And we were really going. We had a wonderful cast. We had Sammy Davis Jr. and Carl Malden and wonderful voices for an animated film. Mm-hmm. And it was canceled. So, I mean, it was three strikes, and they say you're out, but we just found another game, and we just kept on going.
Right.
So for 46 years, mind you, these demo records and recordings were just sitting in my closet. And just
to explain for those who don't know the lingo songwriting, a demo record is what would you have been doing it yourself?
Yeah, well, a lot of them were done with the original cast album.
You did?
The original people. We were going to do one was a complete demonstration without the cast. It was just good singers, and the others were actually the voices of the characters who were going to play in Sir Puss in Boots, and it was a conglomeration of things. And Bruce said, "This is going to make a great album. It's going to be called The Unsung Sherman Brothers," just like he had done an album called The Unsung Sondheim and The Unsung Berlin. So I said, that's nice company to be in.
Right, yeah.
I said, thank you so very much. So it's coming out very shortly, and that's what I was working on last week. I was in a studio doing something.
But how exciting and how wonderful that these dormant songs, long dormant songs, will finally get some life.
Yes, it's very exciting for me. It's, it's satisfying, you know, it's something that... Because I've been very lucky, you know. I've had a lot of things that have seen the light of day, and I'm very proud of them. And Bob and I had a good run of about 50 years of writing. So these are kind of like a cherry on top of the ice cream sundae, because we really have these are old friends that have gone for a long time, and it's just kind of a funny thing to be talking about now.
Well, you've revisited a number of old friends lately when they did the new movie of The Jungle Book.
Oh, yes.
This year. They asked you to come in and write a new verse.
Yes, that was kind of fun. I was actually working on a stage version of Jungle Book when it was sort of pulled off the market because they decided they were going to do this gigantic CGI film. Which I said, oh, why are they going to do that? I was very upset about it. But then they asked me, could I come in and work with them on this one sequence that they wanted to bring it into this new telling of the story. So I had a lot of fun with that. There was a character, the big ape. You know, remember we had King Louis, the swinger? Now they got the largest ape in the world, called a Gigantopithecus. That's a gigantic word.
That sounds like a word you would make up.
I know. When they told me about this, we have this Gigantopithecus, and he's a kind of a scare. I said, can I use that if you want?
Yeah.
You know, she said, oh, yeah. So I used it twice in this song.
Of course you did. Of course you did.
You might think it's ridiculous that me, a Gigantopithecus, whatever dream, I'd like to team with the likes of you, man cub. You know, I had a little fun with those things.
Oh, that's wonderful. And that was what Christopher Walken got to say.
Chris Walken, right. Mm-hmm. And we recorded him, and he was fun. He was a lot of fun to do it with. And yeah, so they used a couple of my songs, the original songs. They used Trust in Me. Scarlett Johansson sang that one. It was kind of nice, you know. But it wasn't the same as the original movie, but this was
I mean, you've lived through so many different periods.
Yes.
You lived through the Tin Pan Alley period. We'll go back and talk about that a little bit,
sure.
Your father came out of.
Yes.
Your father, Al Sherman.
Right.
And then you went through the rock and roll era. I mean, not everybody knows, I suspect, that you wrote You're 16, You're Beautiful, and You're Mine.
Oh, yeah. Well, Bob
and I... Which was a chart topper twice.
It was, yes.
Explain that.
Well, actually, we wrote it back in 1958, I think it was. And it didn't come out till 59 when Johnny Burnett sang it. And he had a wonderful record. And it became a big hit.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 15 years later, 14 years later, Ringo Starr did it, and it became even a bigger hit. It was an international hit. And, you know, I was kind of tickled because these kids were looking at me with, oh, I said, you wrote that? And I said, yeah, I did. It's an old guy like you wrote that song? Yeah.
So you've lived through that. You lived through the rock and roll period.
Oh, yes.
And then there was a time when there were... The record companies had a sort of a system. It was very codified, and they had every record label had an instrumentalist on contract,
right?
And a female singer and a male singer doing pop material, what we used to call pop material.
Popular, yeah.
And that's how you got into that world, because you and your brother Bob got hired to write for Annette Funicello.
Well, that was actually the most wonderful. Serendipity, you know, lucky accident. We were We had written a little tune called Tall Paul, He's My All. And we recorded it with a youngster by the name of Judy Harriet on a little label mm-hmm. called Surf Records. I mean, it was just a little tiny recording. And she did a great job. She was quite good at it. The record never got anywhere. It never mm-hmm. never really took off. But somebody at Disney Studio had gotten a memo that they're going to take Annette, who was a big star of the Mouseketeers show, the television show.
The Mickey Mouse Club.
And the Mickey Mouse Club, right. And they were going to put her on recordings because she was so popular. And so they were looking for material. And this fellow, Mo Pascal at Disney, heard this song of ours on the radio. And he looked up to find out where he could get this song. And we were asked to work out a deal so that they could record it. So my brother Bob, who ran the business end of it, certainly did it. And Annette had a huge hit with it. And the next thing we know, they were so nice, they said, if you have any more songs for Annette, you know, said, oh, yeah. So we started writing songs for Annette. And they said, we have a couple of openings on this next session we're going to do four songs. So we brought in about five things, and recorded four of our songs that next.
Wow.
They liked what we were writing because we were writing just for her. We didn't know this, but Walt Disney had discovered Annette. And she was a sweetheart. She was a wonderful girl. And he was very fond of her. She was about 14 at the time. And so he'd hear every song that we wrote. And we started writing regularly for her. We did albums for her. The first album was called Annette. And the second album, they wanted to do something with a theme. So we said, how about Hawaiian music? So we wrote Hawaiianette. And it was a whole album. It was a one-word title, Hawaiianette. And that became a big hit. And then we said, next album we'll do, she's Italian, so let's do Italianette, you know. And so we wrote the Italian songs. And then it was kind of fun. We kept writing things for her. And she said, you know, if I ever get married and I have a house, would you write Kitchenette for me? You know, and then if I have a baby, you call it Bathinette. Yeah, oh, yes, of course we're going to write all those songs. Basically, Walt Disney heard our material that way. He heard a tremendous amount. We were auditioning for him. We didn't even know this. And so one day they were going to put Annette into a film. It was called The Horse Masters. And it was a television film, a two-parter. And they needed a song for her to sing. So we said, okay, we'll write some. We wrote her a song. And this time, when we played it for the executive that we'd been always dealing with, he said, whenever it's a production, Walt Disney has to hear it himself. So he said, okay, we'll make a demo. He said, no. He likes to hear it from the writers. So he said, oh, God, you know, right. Well, so what should we do? He says, we're going to go and see him right now. So we went over to Walt Disney's office. I was petrified.
And how old were you?
I was 31. But I was quivering my boots like I was 12. I was very scared. And Bob and I walked into his office, and he was very friendly. You know, he was very nice. And he said, are you guys really brothers, or is this just a brother act? We said, no, we're the same family, really, sir. And we were told, never call him Mr. Disney. You call him Walt. He likes that. So we said, yes, Mr. Disney. I mean, Walt. I mean, sir. I mean, we were very terrified. So he says, well, what have you got for me? So we had played him this song. Prior to our playing the song, I remember now, he said, this is all about these twins that meet in a summer camp. And he started describing what The Parent Trap was. That was another movie. And we were petrified. We said, Mr. Disney, I mean, Walt, I mean, sir, we came here to play a song for Annette for the Horse Masters. So finally, I got through the song I sang. It was called Strumming Song. I finished Strumming Song, played it for him, and he said, yeah, that'll work. Now, listen, I spent a lot of time on this other thing. His biggest compliment in the world would be, that'll work.
That'll work. Yeah.
He never ever said, wonderful, great, just what I wanted. He never did that to anybody. But he'd look at something and, yeah, that'll work. That's about what you got out of him. But then when you knew that, you were up in the sky. You were just so happy because you pleased the boss. We didn't realize this, but he liked us a lot. He really did. He liked our songs. And he kept us giving us more assignments.
Well, there was the transition again from rock and roll songwriters, would-be rock and roll songwriters,
right.
to employed rock and roll songwriters.
Employed.
Yes.
That's a rare one.
To movie soundtrack songwriters.
Well, you know, that's, again, it all came about that time because when we finished playing this little song for that was for Annette, he said, now that I wasted all my time on this other picture, it wasn't called The Parent Trap at that time. It was called We Belong Together. And he said, I don't like the title. Can you think of a better title? Think of something that we didn't actually think of Parent Trap. We thought of a song called Let's Get Together. Mm. We said that would be a good title. And so we played that for him. It was a rocker. Mm. And he says, perfect for the twins. We'll do that in the same picture. But he didn't say perfect for the twins. He said, yeah, that'll work for the twins. That's what we got out of. And then we needed a reminiscence, a love song that the parents remembered because they were going to plot to get them together. So Bob and I said, well, listen, it takes place in 1961. That's when the picture will be released. So we have to think back to when before the children were born. This is where our brains were working. Mm. We said, before these twins were born would be about 1966 or 7. Let's write a 1967 love song that Perry Como would sing. Mm-hmm. So we wrote a very pretty little lilting song called For Now, For Always. Sounded very period. And when we played that for Walt, I remember we played for him, he says, that's a very old-fashioned song. So I said, yes, Walt, that's because that was 1946. That's when that song should have been their love song. So it really struck a chord with him. He liked that. And he said, you think period? We said, yes, we do. We think period. You have to write where the song should be. So he said, yeah. He hated anachronism, where you wrote a contemporary song for a period piece or something. Mm-hmm. He hated that. And so he liked the fact that we could zonk into a period. So he started giving us one assignment after another, and then finally one day he handed us a book. And the book.
And that's a whole story that we'll get to, but that's Mary Poppins.
That is Mary Poppins.
And I want to go backwards, though, just before we lose this particular train of thought, is that this talent, this gift that you and your brother Bob had didn't come out of nowhere.
Oh,
because,
no.
Because your dad was a working songwriter in what they used to call colloquially Tin Pan Alley.
Tin Pan Alley, right.
There was no such place, really, but it was...
It was a mythical name.
A mythical name that came out of New York show business, and it had to do with guys who wrote songs on order.
Songs by the barrel,
by the bushel. What do you need?
You need a love song.
You need a love song, right. We can do a love song, yeah. You need a song about a bottle of water? We'll give you a bottle of water song.
Well, it was a time, you know, Tin Pan Alley came from that expression came from the fact that in the summertime, all the windows were open in these publishing houses, these little cubbyhole publishers and the big publishers, too. And so this sound of pianos tinkling sounded mm-hmm. like a bunch of tin pans banging together. And somebody nicknamed it that. And that was just that section of town in New York where you heard all these pop songs being written and manufactured and demonstrated. And my dad came in from that. He called it the mill. I came from that mill. And he wrote some great songs. My dad wrote songs for Eddie Cantor. Remember the great comic and radio comic and everything? He wrote, the potatoes are cheaper, tomatoes are cheaper, now's the time to fall in love.
That was a Depression era song.
Very big Depression song. And he wrote a classic standard called You Gotta Be a Football Hero. You Gotta Be a Football Ball Hero. They still play it today.
You know who played it all the time until David Letterman left the air? It was a standard on that show because Paul Schaefer, his music director, right. has an encyclopedic knowledge of popular music. Mm-hmm. And whenever they had a football guest,
right,
like a star who just played in the Super Bowl, that's the music they play to bring him on. You gotta be a football hero. Now, how many people in the contemporary audience recognize that?
The two of you. That's who recognized it. You guys.
Made me smile.
Yep. Yeah.
So that was always fun. One of my favorite song titles of your dad's, I have a little advertisement for it with Rudy Valli, who introduced it. 99 out of 100 want to be kissed. Why don't you?
Yeah. Well, actually, he got these ideas many times just by coming into town. He saw on the subway a sign that said, 9 out of 10 people have pyorrhea. You know, it was about something to do with your gums. And he says, 9 out of 10, 10 out of 20, 99 out of 100. 99 of 100, not pyorrhea. 99 out of 100.
Well, I'm glad he went off of that track, yes.
99 out of 100 want to be kissed. Why don't you? 99 out of 100 wouldn't resist. Why don't you? And he had this idea for the song, 99 out of 100 want to be loved. Why don't you? And it's a cute idea.
Yeah.
And Dad wrote it with a fellow named Bill Al Lewis, and they became very successful together. So that was a... But that Dad was a great songwriter. He really wrote wonderful, wonderful tunes. And
but he actually encouraged the two of you. I mean, I'm shortening the story because we don't have 3 hours today. you could fill 3 hours, Richard, easily, and many, many more. But that was not the path that either you or your brother was on.
Well, no, actually, I liked the idea of writing music. I loved the idea of writing music and composing and writing songs. And I wanted to write for the theater. I didn't necessarily want to write pop music. And Bob wanted to write novels. And we got out of college. We finished college at Bard College, New York State. And we were living in this little apartment. And Bob was writing the great American novel and Digging a Hole in the Ground, and I was writing the Great American musical in Digging a Hole in the Ground. And Dad came up to our little office, our little apartment, which was our office as well, and he said, I bet you guys, with all your college education and everything, have enough brains to write a popular song that some kid would give up his lunch money to buy the record. So he threw a gauntlet down. He said, that was the challenge. And we said, what do you mean? He said, I bet you couldn't write a pop tunes. I bet you couldn't listen to the radio and see how they write those things, and you could do it. And so we started to listen, just out of curiosity, see if we could do it. So we started listening, and those early 50s were country western music. A lot of country western songs were coming out, half as much, songs like wonderful songs. So we were listening to these songs, and we decided, okay, we'll write a little country western song. So we wrote a song called Gold Can Buy Anything But Love. We had a hook. He said, you got to look for a hook. Because that's an audacious thing to say, gold can buy anything. You can't buy everything, but you can't buy love. Mm. So we had that little hook, gold can buy anything but love, and Dad said, now you got a pop tune. This is a good... And our very first recording was Gene Autry, a great singer of the popular music of that day.
And a big hit maker, too.
He
had just recorded Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and had a tremendous hit with that, and as well as his usual Western songs. So that was a big deal.
But we learned a lesson from that song, because although we got the recording, and it was a wonderful recording, it was a historical period of time when General MacArthur had just been recalled from Korea because he had stepped over the 38th parallel. This is history. And President Truman didn't like the idea that he was overriding what the president's edict was. Don't go over the 38th parallel. So he was recalled, and he made a farewell speech to Congress, and he says, and as I step down from my position, I want to recall an old barracks room ballad we used to sing at West Point. Old soldiers never die, they just fade away. Overnight, Gene Autry recorded Old Soldiers Never Die. Our song was taken off the presses.
And
it was destroyed. It was the end of it. We never, ever got another spin on the radio
it's
or anything
timing.
From it.
It's all timing.
It was all time. It was terrible. And Bob and I were so crushed.
Yeah.
And I remember Dad came up to our little apartment. We felt so good, and then all of a sudden so terrible. And he said, that's called a curve. And if you can't take a curve, you get out of the game. And that was a good lesson for us. He says, no, we're not going to get out of the game. We'll keep trying. Because we had the bug. Now we said, if we can write a song that Gene Autry will record, we can write a song that somebody else can record.
Absolutely.
So we stayed in the game and eventually got
lucky. And it didn't work out. And it didn't work out at all.
No.
When you started writing with Bob.
Yes.
What were you able to do for each other? Well, what came easily to you, and what came easily to him?
I'd say this way: Bob and I were mutually involved in the concept, the idea, because we always felt, and I still to this day feel this way, there are three parts to a really good song: the idea behind it, the reason for it, the heartbeat of it. What is it for? That's the next thing is the music and the lyrics. Music came very easy to me. I was always very natural with the music. And Bob and I would sweat over the lyrics and over the titles to make sure that they were right. And so we sort of collaborated on everything. We always said, well, it was the three of us. I mean, the three of us. It was the idea, the music, and the lyrics. But Bob and I actually collaborated on lyrics and ideas, and I wrote the music.
Well, it worked.
Yeah.
It worked, and it worked for years. And I'm very proud of the stuff that Bob and I did together. It was 50 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
And what did you keep most from what your dad said? What really stuck with you?
He gave us a lesson. He said, keep them simple, singable, sincere, and overall original. That was it. So no matter what we wrote, we always try to keep it so that somebody could pick it up and sing it.
Absolutely.
Simple, singable, sincere, and original. So there's a magic to that. Many times you hear songs today, you can't recall them. You can't recall the melody.
Yep.
Sometimes it's clever stuff going on, but it's coming at you like a machine gun. You don't know what you're listening to. You can't take it with you. But Bob and I came from that school where we want you to take it with you. We want to give you a catchphrase that you can get in your heart and in your mind and hum it and enjoy it. And people want to kiss us and kill us for some of the songs we've written because they can't get them out of their heads. But the point is we strove to get that and to keep them original, keep them not like somebody else wrote it, like we wrote it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, simplicity is very hard to achieve.
It is.
That's a very well put. It is truly. You know who was one of the greatest simple writers? And if you analyze his work,
Irving Berlin.
Yes. You got it. Oh, very smart.
Irving Berlin.
His deceptively simple stuff. Mm-hmm.
It was, I'll be loving you always.
Songs
like that. I mean, you could study for decades and never achieve what he did in songs like that. They're still beautiful.
He was a perfectionist. Yeah. And he wrote a song called All Alone.
Breaks my heart, that song.
Now, I'll tell you, that song is an incredible song. When my dad was a young man writing songs, Irving Berlin was publishing other writers as well as his own material.
Mm-hmm.
And Dad brought him in a song one day, and he played it for Irving, and he said, it's a good song, Al. Yeah, listen, I want you to hear something I'm working on. I can't finish it. I got a song with you. Listen to this. Tell me what you think. So he played him All Alone. I'm so all alone. And he got up to a point where it was near the end of the song. All alone by the telephone, waiting for a ring, a ting-a-ling. I'm all alone feeling lonely, all alone feeling blue. And he says, now I don't know what to say. And Dad said, Irving, you'll find the answer to it. Just give us some time. He says, I've been working and working. He says, go away from it. You'll come back. So he talked to him like that because he was a nice man. About 8 months or 9 months later, Irving Berlin came up with the greatest ending to a song he could ever hear. I'm so all alone, feeling lonesome, all alone, feeling blue. Wondering how you are.
Where you are and how you are.
And if you are all alone too.
Yep.
Great. You know the song.
Of course I do.
That's great, great, great writing. Simple, simple, simple. Everybody says, it's been around. No, he pulled it out of the cosmos and pulled it in there. It's wonderful. Yeah.
Tell us the story. I'm going to cue you to tell the story because it's such a sweet story that years later, you and Bob got to work with one of your idols and one of the great, great icons of show business, legends of show business, Bing Crosby.
Oh.
And you were recording with him and you brought your dad along to the recording session.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, one of the greatest memories in the world was Bing Crosby's memory. He remembered everything. He was meticulous in remembering things.
Like you.
Well, not so much me.
You remember every lyric to every song.
That's about it. But I don't remember my phone number. I don't remember my phone number.
It's okay. You don't need that. You don't need that.
But actually, this was a very special thing because I always loved the way he performed songs. He was just the greatest to me, still is. And we had done a special called Goldilocks, and his little girl at the time, Mary Frances, was playing Goldilocks. They dyed her hair gold. She looked beautiful, and it was a fun project. And so he was going to record versions of it, pop versions. So we were in the studio with him, and my dad had written quite a number of songs for Bing in the early years, and so I said, Dad, can you come with us? We're going to record Bing today. So he says, oh, my God, sure, I'd love to. So he was up in the booth, and there was Bing down there listening to the playbacks and working on them. And Bob and I were down in the booth with Bing, working with him. And at one point, he looked up at Dad in the booth, and he signaled, like, are these your boys, you know? Because it was Sherman and Al Sherman and Bob and Dick Sherman. So Dad said, yes. So he gave him the thumbs up. We went like that. I'll never forget that because my idol was telling my dad we were good writers.
Wow.
It meant everything to me.
It doesn't get better. Those moments.
I've been very privileged and lucky to have been working with some of the great, great people I've worked with.
Now, we're going to get into... Excuse me, I have a frog today that doesn't want to go away. That's me trying to get the frog to go away. We're going to talk a bit about Mary Poppins right now because we're talking about integrating songs into movies.
Yeah.
And this is supposed to be about movies, this podcast. Mm-hmm. And we're going to get there because what you and Bob did in that and so many other films was not just sort of insert song here, mm-hmm. but integrate song.
Tell story with song.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But there's another story I want you to tell, which is growing up in Hollywood.
Oh.
Now, you have to understand, I come from the other end of the country. I'm from the other coast. I was born in Manhattan, but I grew up mostly in New Jersey. So Hollywood was always kind of a fantasy land to me. So when I hear you tell some of your stories about just ordinary, everyday life, going to school, and some of the people you went to school with, and some of your friends, and some of the people you got to meet, it blows my mind.
Well, I you know, it's a funny thing. When you're 10, 11, 12 years old, you don't think about it as being very odd or strange. But I did have one wonderful little friend named Lois, and her name was Lois Laurel. And I was 12, she was 12, and we were in school together, and I was terrible at spelling. So she used to always push her paper so that I could read. She sat in front of me so I could read how to spell certain words, you know. Tongue, T-O-N-G-U-E. I mean, who spells like that? But that's the way you spell. So I could learn that. So anyhow, Lois was my friend, and she was having a birthday party. I think it was her 12th birthday. And so she said, my daddy's throwing a party for us, and I'd like the class to come. So our whole class was invited. She said, it's not in my house. It's in the valley because daddy lives in the valley, and I live with mommy in town in Beverly Hills. So because we lived in Beverly Hills. So I said, well, sure. So my dad drove me out to this nice little homestead out there. There's several acres and everything and a nice house. And he dropped me off. And so I went in, and there was all my classmates, and we're having a lot of fun and talking. And then this nice man says, well, it's time for the movies. Let's go to the movie theater. So in the back there was this huge barn-like place, and that was like for movies. And so he was running a Laurel and Hardy movie. And I was looking at the Laurel and Hardy movie, and then I looked at the fellow who was projecting the movie, who was laughing as much as the other kids. And he was a little gray, but the same face as the guy. It was Laurel. It was Stan Laurel. And, I mean, it was such a thrill to see. And I said, are you? And he said, yes, I am. Oh, gee, wow. I mean, what do you say? It was just, but he was just a sweet, lovely man. And Lois Laurel was his daughter, and he was throwing a party for her. So that's the kind of wonderful things that did happen in town.
But you took it for granted. It was just life.
That was the life. I met so many kids. One of the fellas I went to sat next to me. I'm Sherman, and he was Sandridge. He was Mark Sandridge. His father was the.
I didn't know that you were in class with Mark Sandridge.
Yeah, well, actually, Mark Sandridge was the great director of so many.
This is Mark Jr., right?
Yeah, this was Mark Jr.
Yeah.
But the Mark Sr. was the guy that directed.
Directed the Fred Astaire Ginger Rogers music.
All those and many other great pictures, Berlin Pictures.
Oh, yeah, Holiday Inn.
Holiday Inn. I mean, mm-hmm. he was a major player, and a lot of people like that. My brother's best friend was Sammy Jr., Samuel Goldwyn Jr. Mm-hmm. Funny story about Samuel. Bob and I were up at Sammy's house, Samuel Goldwyn's house, one day because they wanted to take, it was 1939 or 1940, and they wanted to take a picture of the spirit of 1940, and they gave me a strap that said 1940 on it, and I had to take all my clothes off except my underwear. And I was standing, and they were shutterbugs. They were taking movies, you know, not movies.
Like amateur photo club.
Amateur photo club, and they were taking pictures of me standing with the new year. They were going to have...
Oh, God.
And Samuel Sr. comes in, and he says, "What are you got people doing in here?" So I said, "I'm the spirit of 1939 or whatever it was." He says, "You don't look very spirited to me." And he left. That was Samuel Goldwyn, the great Samuel Goldwyn, the days of our lives and all this great
and best
years of our lives.
Best years of our lives, exactly. Yeah. And another of your classmates is about to get an honorary Academy Award. The great casting director, Lynn Stallmaster.
Oh, Lynn and I were buddies. We were friends together. Yeah, we were both in public speaking. We were both very involved in debate and that type of thing. And Lynn is a lovely man. He was one of the super casting directors. He started out as an actor. He was started as an actor, but he went into casting, and he had a great talent for that, to spot faces and see people.
Yeah, launched a lot of careers.
Oh, yeah. He was Stallmaster Lister, and then it was Stallmaster on his own, and he was very, very successful. Nice, nice guy.
So and you absorbed a lot of this, and who knows what of the things you did absorb and observe informed you? I can remember the last time I saw Mary Poppins at a major screening. I think we were all there together at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And, oh, I know what it was. The Academy was showing Gunga Din. That's what it was.
Oh.
And I'm watching the great movie Gunga Din, George Stevens' movie with Cary Grant.
Oh, yes.
And Victor McLaughlin.
Yeah.
And Douglas Fairbanks Jr.
Right.
And Cary Grant, and I can't imitate his voice. Others could, but I cannot. Says something about dukes and maharajas.
Oh, yes.
And I said, wait a minute. Dukes and maharajas, I know that turn of phrase.
Actually, I stole it. This is when I was a little boy, I saw Gunga Din. And it was 1941 or something like that. And I remember they were these soldiers, these British soldiers, were all up in this temple, up on a high place, and there was a frieze of solid gold all around this encrusted area, and these terrible people were down below ready to kill them.
Tuggies.
And so Cary Grant looked at this frieze, and there was a hand sticking out. He said, look at that hand. If I just had that hand, I could be a duke or a maharaja. I'd be so. And I loved the sound of the way he said it. And so we're working on Mary Poppins 25 years later. and I said, when dukes and maharajas pass the time of day with me, I say me special word, and then they ask me out to tea. Well, of course, it was only you would. Of all
you
the people
it.
In the world.
He Leonard, made it all these years.
Leonard Maltin got there. He said, now you have choose me a
stealing. No, not stealing.
Influenced.
It's an homage.
Exactly.
Thank you.
It's an homage.
Whenever you're at a loss, it's homage, of course. But that was true.
Now, again, to get back to Mary Poppins, the magic of Mary Poppins, and that's a subject in itself, and Jesse and I are true believers when it comes to that movie, as many other millions of people are, you didn't just write the songs. That wasn't what Walt assigned you to do.
No.
Tell us what you actually did on that movie that made everything come together in such a unified and harmonious way.
Well, Bob and I were working. He had put us on his staff as his staff songwriters, and he gave us this book one day, and he said, take this book and tell me what you think. He didn't say, I want you to write me a song for it or a theme or anything like that. He just said, tell me what you think. So we read this wonderful series of stories about a magical nanny who comes into this family and does wonderful stuff and flies away again. There was no storyline in it. It was just a series of wonderful adventures. And we realized he liked the fact that we were story guys. We thought of stories. So we said, let's try to put together a story where this could be a great musical if it could work. So we picked out six chapters out of this first book of Mary Poppins stories. And we said, we have to have a reason for her to come in. There's problems in the family. Remember the song Trouble in River City? You know, where we said there's got to be trouble in the Banks house. There's got to be problems. And the problem is this. that the kids are getting unruly. The mother's too busy with her cause. The father's too busy at the bank. They don't pay attention to their kids. Mary Poppins comes in and teaches a life lesson to them, and they get a unity together, and then her job is done and she can fly away. This was a concept we had, because otherwise you wouldn't have a story, a reason for her coming.
Yeah.
Because Mrs. Travers never explained, is the author of the stories, never explained anything. And she took a great pride in the fact that she didn't explain anything. But if you're going to sit somebody down in a chair for 2 hours, you're going to have a reason to hold them there. It has to be a plot. And so he said, we've got to have somebody learning something. The father practically loses his job, and he takes them out and flies a kite with his kids, because that's the important thing. Well, we had this concept, and we talked with great enthusiasm to Walt about this. I said, yep, I think we'll work on this. He said, I want you to work with Don DeGrotti. He's an artist, and he's a great story guy, and you'll work with him. So Bob and I, for 2.5 years, really, over 2 years, slaved on this thing. And then when Mrs. Travers finally came, we had to convince her. And there's a movie about that.
So, that's right, Saving Mr. Banks.
Saving Mr. Banks. She didn't like anything we did, because she didn't create the story. She resented. It's called Saving Mr. Banks because we had to make somebody the heavy. He's, you know, the problem. And Mrs. Travers had a very terrible life as a youngster. And so she created this fictional father who was perfect. He went to the bank every day, made money, and came home. And if you're going to do a movie, you can't do that. But we didn't know her problems. All we knew was she gave us this wonderful character and a wonderful incidents and nothing else. Oh, a little thing about the incidents. We took 6 chapters, which we thought would be the wonderful meaty ones that we could work with to tell our story. And they were the same chapters Walt had selected. We didn't even know that. Mm-hmm. But when we told him about it, and he looked at our book, and he chuckled, and he pulled out his book and said, there, look. It was amazing. But we were right on the same kind of like wavelength with the boss. And he was an incredible man, a wonderful, wonderful
man. Now, people who saw Saving Mr. Banks and think that there was any exaggeration in the telling of that story of how Mary Poppins came about and how the two of you, and you were played by Jason Schwartzman.
Jason Schwartzman, right.
And your brother was played by B.J. Novak.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Hanks did a lovely job playing Walt Disney.
And
Emma Thompson played
flawless as Mrs.
Travers.
Yes.
At the end of the movie, and I thought this was so smart of them to do, if you stay through the credits or if you're watching it at home, streaming it or watching it on DVD or whatever, or Blu-ray, stay through the credits and listen to the actual tape recording. You see the tape recorder going.
Right.
Of the actual story conference with you and the almost impossibly stubborn Mrs. Travers. And if you want to hear more of it, it's on the CDs, the most recent CD releases of the Mary Poppins soundtrack. I can't bear to listen to them for more than 10 minutes.
No, they're rough. And you lived them.
There are 16 hours of them.
16 hours.
Let me give you first of all, she insisted. She insisted every time we had a meeting, every word has to be transcribed, so that she could not be misunderstood.
And that's why the tapes exist.
And that's why and I was given a set of those tapes, and I never, ever could bear to play them. I listened to one first for about 5 minutes, and I said, oh, my God, I can't do this again.
Right.
And I just put it away. Years and years later, when they were doing this film, I said, if you'd like to hear something interesting, I'll give you this. And I gave them the film, and so our director, wonderful guy, decided I'm going to put them at the end. I'm going to show.
Yeah.
She did sound like that. She was like that. And you heard nothing compared to what she. I couldn't get through a song. I couldn't get through a song without her interrupting. Everything we tried to do, she just. Nope. A lot of it is that dialogue in the film is just actually the transcriptions. Like I was singing supercalifragilistic. We thought it would be fun to have Mary Poppins give them a fun song to sing. It was just a fun idea. And we said we just did it so the kids would have a gift from Mary Poppins, a little special thing. And she said, but it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't exist. I said, but that's what she gave them. It's something nonsensical. It's fun for them. She didn't like that.
No.
Why? Because she didn't think of it. It's just one of those things.
Yep.
Mrs. Travers was difficult. Difficult.
Difficult. Now, if I read my research correctly, you wrote 35 songs altogether for
Mary
Poppins.
We did, yeah. Well, because we were researching different chapters. We kept researching, and we were working with a wonderful guy named Don DeGrady. He was our third brain in this thing.
And he was a story artist.
He was a story artist, that's right. We could describe a sequence, and he could draw it. You could see it. And with the Jolly Holiday and everything, were things that he actually came up with these things. He was a brilliant guy, and then
he could not only come up with an idea, but then visualize it and
totally visualize it with story. We call storyboards, little pictures. You draw them and put the dialogue under them, and you could see the movie by looking at the storyboards. And then we had the great joy of working with one of the finest writers at the studio, and certainly one of the finest writers in Hollywood named Bill Walsh, who wrote this brilliant dialogue. It's funny, funny stuff. It was all Bill, really. And so the collaboration was five of us. It was Walt Disney, who ran the whole show, and Don DeGrady, Bill Walsh, Bob, and myself. And we created the Mary Poppins that everybody knows. Mm-hmm. Because the Mary Poppins that Mrs. Travers wrote is the nucleus. It's the character. Mm-hmm. It's the incidents, but not the story.
Yeah.
The story was basically something that was concocted by five little guys in Hollywood. No, one big guy and four other guys in Hollywood who just sat in these rooms and thrashed it out and worked on it. And it was a labor of love on all of our parts. It was a special thing. And we all were working on five other things, but that was the one that we kept coming back to and having meetings with. And Walt was so responsible for so much of it. I mean, you know when the cannon goes off and everybody's sort of grabbing things? That was all Walt Disney. He came up with these things. He says, well, you don't have the cannon go off. We have to have people paying no attention to it, just holding the piano back and doing and then pushing things back in place. And meticulously, Don described and drew pictures of what would happen so that this one little explosion of the thing took weeks to figure out how to do it. And everybody giggles and laughs and enjoys it. This was all just one example of what we did in this period of time. But it's a very special thing in my life. And it was the open door for me to writing other films after that. Because once we did that musical film and it was a success, people had confidence and they gave us other things to do, including Walt himself.
Right. And again, you always had in mind that whether you were writing Tom Sawyer, which you did,
that's right,
or Charlotte's Web, the animated version of Charlotte's Web, which you did
right,
for Hanna-Barbera, or any number of other films that you worked on, you always maintained that same integrity of having the songs come out of the situations or express a character's desires or motivations.
I mean, you figured out ways to speak for both Winnie the Pooh and Tigger. That's saying a lot.
Well,
did you come up with Tigger's laugh? Or did Tigger already have his laugh?
The laugh actually was
Paul Winchell.
Paul Winchell, wonderful voice man. And, he was a brilliant man.
I grew up watching him as a ventriloquist and entertainer, of course.
He created the heart valve.
That's right, the
artificial heart valve.
And the Tigger laugh. I don't know which one's more important. One of them.
Well,
but
both of them.
But you came up with the theme for the Enchanted Tiki Room.
Yeah, you did.
Tiki Room. Oh,
all through Disneyland.
Funny, we had these great assignments. I mean, Walt would pop into the office and say, "I need a song for," and then okay, what do you want, Walt? And so so one day he said, "Come down to." Oh yeah, I remember this was very funny. He said, "Come down to stage two after lunch." Okay, stage two at the studio. We went down to stage two, and there was a mock-up of a sort of a jungle room. And we sat down in bridge chairs. And he said, "Okay, turn it on." So all of a sudden, came this show, and it was flowers singing and birds in singing songs and everything. And it was all, when it was all through, and tiki torches chanting, "Ugga booga, ugga booga," all this type of thing. And when it was all, he said, "Okay, kill it. So he said, "What do you think?" So we said, "Great, Walt, what is it?" And he said, "Everybody says the same thing, what is it?" We said, what is it? He said, "You're going to write a song about it. You'll explain what it's all about." "How can we explain what it's all about? We don't know ourselves." we said, if you had an articulate character who could talk like a parrot, you don't have any parrots. He says, we could have four parrots. He'd always plus things. We'll have a French parrot. We'll have a we'll have a Russian parrot. You know, he had four different parrots going, he said, with accents. And so he said, what are they going to sing? Well, it's tropical. We'll write a tropical song. Calypso. He says, good. What are you going to call it? He says, what's the name of this place? He says, it's called the Enchanted Tiki Room. That's a mouthful. Tiki, tiki, that's a good word. How about tiki, tiki, tiki? He says, I like that. We're gonna call it the tiki, tiki, tiki room. He says, good. So when am I going to have my song? he was very funny. He didn't mess with us. So he said, we'll have it as soon as we can, Walt. So it's been playing for 50 years.
Yeah, it has.
It's explaining what is all the birds sing words
and the flowers croon. Of course they do.
Yes.
What else would they be doing in the tiki, 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 tiki room?
Well said.
Thank you.
And basically, that's the way it was. We had a lot of lovely time with Walt. He would always come up with these wonderful assignments for us, and we had a good time doing them. We had a great rapport with him. He was a wonderful, wonderful boss. And everybody that worked for him felt that way.
Yeah.
Now, of course, as you well know, Richard, you know, Walt takes a lot of hits. There are people who weren't there, who weren't alive.
Right.
Who weren't witness to anything, who are only too happy to accuse Walt Disney of all sorts of things. And
we
won't go through a litany of accusations, but you know what I'm talking about.
Walt Disney was a great, liberal, open-minded man, and that's what he was. And he didn't have any prejudices, none whatsoever.
Well, there's a statement.
Yeah.
There you have it.
We feel very, as obviously you do because you knew him personally, we're very defensive of Walt.
Well,
protective of Walt.
I'm glad.
And something that I say to my friends all the time, because I have a lot of friends who love Disney, love going to Disneyland, is that when you watch, you know, so my dad's perfect example of someone who grew up watching Uncle Walt, and he came into your home and he spoke to you, and he didn't talk to any. I mean, all of you have talked about this my whole life. He didn't talk to kids as if they were kids. He didn't talk down to them. He spoke to them as if they were the same,
right.
and they were equal. And so even now, and this is what I find so incredible about him and what he could do, the way my dad felt is exactly how I feel. When I watch him, I'm immediately engaged. I want to call him Uncle Walt. I want to sit next to him and have him tell me stories. He's so warm and lovely. And so excited. And you can understand why someone like you and your brother would want to please him. Because he just, you know, you say he brought the best out of people.
He did. He
got
truly
the best
was.
Out of everyone.
It's very heartwarming to hear people say that, because so many people say, oh, he was prejudiced, he was this, he was that. It was not true. Not true at all. And if you knew him, you'd know it wasn't true.
Now, he was a tough boss.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Tough boss.
He was a demanding boss, but he demanded nothing more than he did of himself.
Yeah.
He drove himself. Oh, of course he did. Here's the thing. He felt like when he had the people that he had around him, they were all very, very good people, very talented, gifted people.
Yeah.
And he liked playing the organ. He was playing all his keys. He knew what to do. He knew which combinations to put together.
Yeah.
And he would sort of inspire you and push you.
Yeah.
And you did things you never dreamed you could do because he wanted you to do them. And I can't explain it. I've never had anything like that since then. But he was a very special, special human being.
Was.
And everything you said about the fact that he was like talking, he was your uncle, he was talking to you personally. He was that guy.
Mm.
He really was that guy. And when he was with us, he could be demanding as hell of people. And if he didn't like negativism. He didn't like people to say, I just don't like it. No, he would kill you for saying something like that. You say, you think of a way to make it better or else keep your mouth shut. He would just snap at his people.
Yeah.
And so we knew better than to say, you know, it doesn't hit me or something.
And we know he wasn't a saint. You know, he was a human being. He had his, you know, his peccadilloes. He had his faults as anybody does.
True.
But it's some of the things that people say, some of the more scurrilous accusations, that really drive me crazy and drive Jesse crazy. Yeah. But we'll move on from there.
Yes.
Because two of the most recent songs.
Let me just say that the conclusion I have come to in my years of being surrounded by brilliant Disney people is the reason that everybody wants to tear Walt down is because they can't believe that he was as magical as he was.
Well, that's true.
And it's very hard to believe in magic, but this is a person who brought magic to you. So if anybody can warm your cold, cold heart, it should be him.
Well, he was fearless, and he put his whole heart and soul into whatever he believed was right and good.
Yeah.
And there's never been anybody like him, really. Mm. Nobody.
Now, we, of course, know that you and Bob wrote It's a Small World for the original attraction that was part of the New York World's Fair originally.
Guilty.
And I attended that New York World's Fair many times as a kid. And then the other big attractions, Mr. Lincoln and the other great stuff, moved out here to Anaheim and eventually became part of the whole Disney theme park world. But you have now lived long enough to have been commissioned to write parodies of your own song. John Landis came to you for Beverly Hills Cop 3 to write a song for a fictitious theme park.
Yes, the Stark Expo. The
Wonder World song, is that what it was called?
Yes.
And then he did it again.
Yeah.
Make Way for Tomorrow Today, which is in two Marvel movies. It's in Iron Man 2, and it's in Captain America the First Avenger.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. These things come around. Years later, people say, who can write a song that sounds like this? So I say, well, Dick Sherman's still alive, and Richard Sherman's still alive. Try him, see if he can do it, you know. And it was just, I just zonk into that period again, think about it, and out comes something. But, it's funny how I've been asked to do things for Jungle Book, and now I'm sort of a conferee on the new Mary Poppins that's being made. And so it's, you know, it's fun.
Well, it beats working.
Yeah, right.
Believe me, it is working. You know?
I think you are the busiest person. I mean, you got to be. You're always traveling. You mentioned earlier that you were working on Jungle Book. That was in Chicago. So you're flying back and forth to Chicago.
Right.
You're flying back and forth to Chicago at the same time that the Mary Poppins stage show was going to Australia.
Yes.
And the World Tour. And Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Yeah.
It's do you sleep?
Oh, I do. I truly do. Listen, I feel very blessed. I have these wonderful projects that I've done over the years, and some of them are, you know, being rekindled and being re-envisioned. And new talent is adding new material to it and making it even more exciting. So to me, it's always kind of fun to some new young writers are working on stuff that I worked on 50 years ago, and they're plussing it and adding new verses to my songs and adding songs of their own that sound kind of marvelous and everything. I personally get a kick out of it. And then they want me to be there to be kind of advise and sort of confer with, et cetera.
And give your blessing and your advice and counsel.
Yeah.
Now, you keep using that term, and that was a Walt term, plussing.
I try to pluss things.
Walt believed in that was always making it that much better, right?
Exactly.
Take something good, make it better.
He would do that all the time. That was his magic. It was the fact that he'd get people who would come up with wonderful stuff. And he'd look at it and say, but if you did such and such, all of a sudden, we can do that. And it happened invariably. It happened with these story meetings. I'll never forget what he would come to a meeting and there was like a storyboard all pinned up for some special things and everything. And he said, you're wasting your gag over here. You should do it here. And he'd take the pins out and push the things. He was so good at it.
Mm.
And people would stand with their mouth open and they'd be exhausted. He says, you got that? And he'd leave. And then he'd leave the room and people would scurry around to remember everything he said. He had a genius for it.
Mm.
And plussing, he called it.
Plussing. Well, Richard, we could go on.
We could. There's one. The only way to end. First of all, this is Richard's first podcast.
Yes.
We're very excited.
Congratulations,
my maiden voyage.
Very excited.
It was actually lots of fun. I had a lovely time. Okay. A lovely time.
So did we?
Yes. Earlier, he said he was casting pods. It's his first time casting pods.
We used to casting pods because you said we're podding casts or something.
We're doing something. The only way to end this is to tell our listeners what you did for Walt every Friday.
Oh, well, among the many songs we wrote for Walt, for Disney, was the score to Poppins. And in the score to Poppins, there was one song that sort of struck a chord with him. He really loved it. It was Feed the Birds, Tuppence a Bag. Because, again, it was Mary Poppins doesn't come out and say, be kind. It doesn't take much to show love, to show caring. She would just say, feed the birds, tuppence a bag. Tuppence means very little money to buy a bag of crumbs. But what it means is it doesn't take much to be loving, to be sweet, be kind. And I think Walt, that was his theme in his life. You said about being everybody's uncle. Mm-hmm. When he was talking to people on that tube, and he was talking to the bot thing, he was talking to those kids. Mm-hmm. I know he was not just acting. He was really talking to the kids. I want to tell you a wonderful story. And then he so enthusiastically would tell you the story because it's the way he was. So I played that song for him. He asked me to come over to his office. So Bob and I would drop in, and he'd say, what are you working on? And he knew what we were working on, but we'd tell him anyhow. And he'd look out the north window at the hills, out of his window in his office, and he'd say, play it. Like, play it again, Sam, you know. And I would sing and play Feed the Birds. And then he'd say, well, have a good weekend, boys. Thanks. And out we'd go. And I bear that in my heart. I'll never forget it. And long after Walt passed away, and I was still at the studio then for several years, I would go into his office on Friday afternoons and play it for him. I did.
That'll work.
That'll work.
That'll work. Well, Richard, thank you so much for coming by today.
Thank you.
Sharing all these wonderful memories. And as I say, he's not a man who lives in the past and who lives in his memories. He's still doing it.
Oh, yeah.
Still writing. And you've recorded some lovely CDs of instrumental music.
Oh, yeah. I keep doing that, too. It's fun to do these things, and I've loved it all my life. I've always done instrumentals for the fun of it, and somebody heard some of them and said, hey, we can use them. And my son Greg and Bob's son Jeff did a documentary.
A documentary called The Boys.
The Boys.
Which is out and available.
Which is out and available. And they used some of my instrumentals in background music there, and some record producer heard it and said, I think that'd be nice. So I said, I got a lot of that stuff. So I did two albums for him. Yes, nice.
That's just great. Well, like Tigger, he's the only one. Mm-hmm. He's Richard Sherman. We're so happy that he was here today. We hope you will join us again next time. You can find me on Twitter at Leonard Maltin and online at my website, leonardmaltin.com. And we hope you will join us again next time.
Thank you very much, Jesse, and thank you very much, Leonard.
Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.